This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Stay tuned, and we're going to talk about Walmart and income inequality today, and maybe a general reassessment of what this show is all about. Okay, so I think this is the second live show in a month here on Occupied Territory. We've had a severe case of broadcasters interruptus, which is extremely painful if you've ever experienced that. I mean, between the hurricane and we're off the air, and then another station was using our airwaves, so we were broadcasting replays, and then being off last Thanksgiving, so it's been a while. And since we've been off, at least live, and this is the first live show in a while, I thought it might be a good opportunity, since it's been about 12 and a half months since this show started, when the Occupy movement started last October, it's been maybe 13 months, to talk about what the show was when it began and what it is now, what it can be and what it should be in the future. We started off right smack during the eruption, the explosion of the Occupy movement, which now seems like an ancient historical footnote. I mean, that's partially due to the fact that time goes so fast and so much is happening. I mean, the speed at which information is given to us from all different places, the quantity and the quality. I mean, thousands of things every second online, over some device, over TV, over radio. There are thousands of internet stations. I don't think that's an exaggeration. Thousands of internet stations. So there's information coming in every direction. And what that tends to do, since it comes in every direction at every minute, it tends to make things old fast. So unless something sort of keeps being new or keeps in the news or establishes a certain quality or uniqueness about itself, right, which is what you hope for when you develop a new show. So the Occupy movement erupts and takes over the national consciousness to the extent that the major media organizations, newspapers, TV, whatever it is, radio, pay any attention to it. And even though they didn't pay attention to it, they made themselves, particularly because of the nature of what they did, they made themselves prominent. They were in your face. They were occupying space, mostly in major cities, all across the country, in Canada. There was one in London, that kind of thing. A lot of this was based on some of the revolutions, real revolutions that had occurred in, when I say real, I mean, people dying, people changing entire governments, societies being turned upside down. A lot of this was based on what happened in Tunisia and in Cairo, in Egypt, the revolutions that occurred over there in the winter and the spring of 2011. And like I say, this all begins to seem like ancient history now, but it's not. It's there every day. Now, you can see what happens when you look at the papers. What's happening internationally is these movements, which then occurred in, although they're complicated, more complicated because it involved outside forces in Libya and now in Syria, and there were demonstrations in Bahrain and a couple of other places, and there's some in Jordan right now. All these dictatorships in the Middle East, hardline, brutal, torturous dictatorships, we'll leave Israel aside for the moment, were overthrown or are in the process of being overthrown or greatly adjusted. Some of them have used plain brute force and locked enough people. They're smaller, like a place like Bahrain is small enough where you can import Saudi tanks, which is what they did, and Saudi weapons, and you have a large trained police force and an army. You can suppress the number of demonstrators there, and things may not be quite as awful for the average person in a place like that as it was in Tunisia. It was inevitable. People were so poor they were starving to death, which is usually the bottom line for any kind of revolution, if you look throughout history. When you look at some of the major great revolutions in history, With one or two exceptions, you're going to see people basically in the mass of people, millions of people, literally starving to death. And then who have nothing to lose and can't take it anymore. I mean, that doesn't always result in a revolution, but it does in some places. So the Occupy movement took its cue from that. And though people in this country were not in the same state of absolute dire poverty where they are starving to death and there's like 30-40% unemployment in some places, and people with college degrees or even advanced college degrees are selling vegetables on the street, we are on a continuum. We're not super far away from that kind of thing. It's not as if we're off that trolley, you know what I mean? But we are getting there. We are getting there, and we can get there even faster. So the idea with Occupy was tremendous income inequality. What was and is our greatest oppression in this country, which results in manifold other dire circumstances and miseries for tens of millions of people, is the inequality of the way wealth and income is distributed. The ownership of corporations and factories, the pay level in different places. And then, of course, you take the constantly rising cost of living of everything. I mean, housing, energy, food, especially food. The price of food has doubled, and it looks like it's going to almost triple in the last 5 years, from 5 years ago till now. And that's always an indicator. Food is always an indicator of where you're going to find massive political upheaval and even revolutions. And there were places in Europe, in Brussels, and even other places, there were farmers were having riots. The government had to call out the army in various European countries where people weren't literally starving to death, but farmers were being put out of business by giant agribusinesses and government cooperation with GMO seeds and all kinds of other things. So this is what happens. And the Occupy movement rose up. That was our American version of this. And a lot of people derided them and ridiculed them because, of course, they weren't poverty-stricken. And most of the people who turned out for Occupy, to be straightforward and honest, since I got very involved with them, and that's why I started up this show. Its show is called Occupied Territory. And that is, once again, for anybody who's new to this program, it's not about the Middle East. We're not talking about occupied territory in the West Bank or Gaza. What we're talking about is the fact that the corporations and the rich have successfully basically occupied all levels of American government, politics, and economics, and even culture, so that we are living in our own country, but basically it's occupied by a very small group of powerful foreign people, otherwise known as the rich or the obscenely rich. That's why it's called occupied territory. So that's why this show rose up. But a lot of the people, and I interviewed many people in the beginning of this show who were at various Occupy sites, maybe a couple of dozen people at, down on Wall Street at what was called Zuccotti Park and a few other places across the country numerous times, people in Denver. And inevitably, what happened was these people were, attacked by militarized police. A lot of Homeland Security equipment was given to local police. Special laws were passed in various cities, which showed how scared people were about this. Because the whole idea of squatting in a public space, after all, America is all about money. And it's all about private property. I mean, the whole world is, mostly. But in America, it is the actual religion of the country. In other places, they have state religions. They have a very strong religious life in other places. They have maybe a socialist ethic or a modified socialist ethic in other countries. The actual religion of the United States, it's not Christianity. It is actually capitalism, even greed. So that's how things are here. So the Occupy group shows up in cities and just squats on public land. I don't think they squatted on any private land, and somebody actually gave it to them, or the city didn't care if they were using it. But it was public land. In other words, it belonged to them, and it belonged to the citizens of the country and the citizens of each city. So they squatted on this land, and they made up their signs, and they marched from those bases of territory within each city on large banks, basically, and banks being the places that were responsible for a lot of this. So this was taken as a threat, as it should have been taken as a threat. Not that I don't think all the big mayors like Rahm Emanuel and Bloomberg and the mayor of Denver and the mayor of Washington, D.C. and all these places have finally wound up sicking the cops on people in what was an extremely brutal way. I mean, tear gas, pepper spray, police batons, beating people up, mass arrests. I mean, it looked like something that you would see, and this is a phrase people use in this country all the time, looked like something you would see in another country. No, it was our country. It was fascist behavior of the worst sort. It was brutal fascist behavior where they broke every constitutional and civil right in the books, right? They beat up people in the press. They detained people in the press. They threw people in the press to the ground. So this is what happens when you go up against the main religion, the large idol, the big god of America, which is profit and capitalism. And this is what people did. They went to Times Square. They went and sat in front of banks. They tried to occupy the lobbies of banks because everybody correctly identified the investment houses like Goldman Sachs being the worst, who has their filthy hands in everything and everybody. And the fact that government is infiltrated to the point where they are more or less a subdivision of investment banks and larger, hedge funds and corporate banks. Also, the very rich. I mean, you can buy elections now, especially since Citizens United. So all these things combined, and you had all these eruptions, which were extremely exhilarating for a lot of people, particularly for a generation like mine that grew up in the 60s and saw these street demonstrations where nonviolent, mostly, sometimes violent, but nonviolent activity on the behalf of hundreds of thousands and literally millions of people over a period of a couple of years, who took to the streets without parade permits, who occupied public space, who blockaded, and this is for the anti-war reasons and for civil rights reasons, blockaded buildings, blockaded the Pentagon, took over various university administrative offices. Why was that done? Here's a piece of real ancient history. Because many university offices, administrative offices, and the presidents of universities were in complete collaboration with the Defense Department. In other words, they were helping to develop weapons. They had labs on campus. They were getting grants from the weapons manufacturers and from large chemical companies and from the Defense Department itself to the tune of tens of millions of dollars to develop new and better ways to kill people. And in other ways, cooperating with the government that they shouldn't have. So this is why a lot of students targeted these places. Now, this was exhilarating for a lot of people, and a lot of people in this country felt it too. And in fact, although the election, the recently passed election, which also seems like ancient history, right? Well, the recently passed election was about a year after Occupy Wall Street started, and after the last encampment, after the last occupied place, there's still one or two, I should say, that exist in the country. After the last occupied place was suppressed by the police, where people were beat up and arrested and shot with rubber bullets and whatever else. After it was decimated, all these places were decimated, it was like, you know, February and March then, and the presidential primaries are just about over, and these two candidates start running against each other. However, what remained, and this is often the case from a large movement, if there isn't actually a change in a law or there isn't actually a change in the real political structure of a government, is the idea. And there's nothing more difficult to kill and nothing more enduring than an idea, which everybody is aware of if you've studied any history or lived any period of time. So basically, the idea remained of income inequality. So, for instance, I mean, gross, obscene income inequality, where people were, CEOs were being paid and are being paid 500 times more than their line workers, like a teller who stands up all day long on their feet and deals with customers and better get the count right or they get fired at, let's say, J.P. Morgan Bank or Morgan Bank or Chase Bank, whatever it's called, make something like 500 times less than the CEO of Chase Bank. They make like maybe $12 an hour or $15 an hour if they work there for a couple of years. And the head of the bank is making what amounts to, I don't know what, $1,000 an hour or $800 an hour, right? $20 million a year. Well, a teller might be making $40,000 a year. And this goes on all over the country in every industry and every corporation. And it never stops. Just today, although this isn't a perfect example of it, we on the front page of the Times, there's an article about football coaches, college football coaches, This is a game, you understand. Football is a game, which we could all remember that. Football is a game, and the coaches in colleges get paid $2-4 million a year, $5 million a year, depending on how big and how successful their football program is or their school is. And they have assistant coaches that get paid several more millions of dollars. They have a coach for putting on your cleats. They have a coach on big time football teams for how to polish your football. I mean, there is no end to it. They have like 20, 30, 40 people on the staff of a football team at a college. And this is money, you know, that gets siphoned off from other programs. They're closed down labs. They're closed down investigative labs, places where things could be invented, new drugs, studies of, astronomy, studies of, cellular biology. These things get closed down unless they're going to make money for the university. And they'll pay all these people to smash into each other and throw a ball, right? So this is what happens. The whole country has gotten so skewed culturally that the worst sort of behavior is rewarded, and rewarded magnificently. And you have to put up with all these candidates. So you had Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, or Barack O'Mitney and Mitt Obama, whoever they were, running against each other. And they're all constantly talking about, although Mitt Romney didn't talk about this so much, but Obama never shut his mouth about the American dream. The American dream. The Occupy movement did not turn out and get so vocal and capture the imaginations of tens of millions of Americans, despite being a press blackout on it. They didn't turn out because they bought this bullshit about the American dream. The American dream doesn't exist anymore. The American dream is a fairy tale that rich people tell the rest of us so that we stay in place, shut up, and don't bother them while they basically eat us. That's what the American dream is. The American dream is essentially a nightmare for everybody else and a wonderful wet dream 24 hours a day if you're at the top of the heap someplace. And, of course, the government goes along with this, so they're essentially corrupt most of the time. And even when they're supposed to investigate these people who are much richer than everybody else, they don't. Either they don't investigate them or they are them. In other words, it's a revolving door between places like the SEC, the Justice Department, and other places, and the heads of corporations or the vice heads of corporations. So here shows up the Occupy movement, people saying this is, you know, people are out of their, they're being put out of their houses. They have barely enough to live on. And meanwhile, people are throwing $1 million birthday parties and they have 88-foot yachts. And they are buying and selling politicians and elections, and they live in, they have 8 different mansions. One of our most recent presidential candidates, Romney had only 3 or 4 giant houses. I think John McCain, they asked him, how many houses do you have? Because there was some question of how many houses. We're not talking about houses. We're not talking about a 4-bedroom ranch house here. not talking about a small apartment. We're talking about mansions, estates. And he didn't even know how many houses he had. This is a guy running for president of the United States talking about the American dream. And the guy, it turns out, had 8 mansions, right? He's married to some wealthy woman who's the head of some beer fortune, or the inheritor of some beer fortune. So, or is that the one? I don't know. Somebody's married to the head of the beer fortune. So what happened is the Occupy movement injected its main complaint and its most righteous complaint that we all share in here, and they invented this idea of the 99%. True enough, you can make cutoff points anywhere you want. You could call 5% of the top of the population or 0.1%, but 1% had a ring to it, you have to admit, and 99% had a ring to it. And it's true. If you take the top 1% of the country, they own the wealth. They own wealth, and they have assets, and they, you know, this is land, property, stocks, bonds, whatever you could possibly imagine. The top 1% of the population of the United States owns something like 50%, give or take a few percentage points, of all of the total amount of stuff, wealth in the country, and has that much money coming in or owns that much money. For instance, and this is apropos of what we're going to talk about here in a little while, the Walton family, who own Walmarts. There are, I think, 5 siblings who are the inheritors of Walmart from Sam Walton, who started it all up in the 50s as a department store and then spread it all over the, you know, the country and then all over the world, much like skin cancer, melanoma. So now it's everywhere. So basically, these 5 siblings have between them somewhere, it's estimated, somewhere between $100 and $120 billion of wealth. So just these five people alone have as much as probably 10 million Americans own. Everything they own, your toothbrush, your house, your car, what you have in your savings account, what if you have anything in your savings account, and the value of what you earn each year. Just five people probably have as much as 5 million other people. And this is the way it goes in this country. So this is why the Occupy movement started up. Because, of course, income inequality equals political fascism. If only a handful of people have all the money and the rest don't have it, except for voting, which is becoming an increasingly shallow, hollow, and meaningless exercise, except for voting, all those 4 years, up to the day before election, probably the day of election and the day after election, all those 4 years on the day, except for the day you vote, when everybody wants your vote and loves you and is talking about the American dream and how they're going to help you out and what's good for you, all those other 4 years are essentially dedicated by the majority of the two parties to enriching the people who are already rich and enriching themselves from the money from the rich and from our tax money, right? And things don't change. The War Department, which is fighting two wars that it shouldn't be fighting, two invasions it should never have made, and is occupied another country. I mean, the United States of America, right? And we went into World War II for various reasons, but you could say a lot of them were decent enough reasons. Our closest allies, England, which was a democracy, nothing is a pure democracy, was being invaded by a bunch of insane mad dog killers, otherwise known as the Germans and the Nazis. And they had to defend themselves, or else they would have been taken over and half of them exterminated. And the same thing would go for us eventually. So we fought that war. And when we went over there and fought, it's not something most people in this country wanted to do. There was a huge isolationist movement, It was one of the largest movements in the country. It could have been Lindbergh was one of the heads of it. He could have run for president on the isolationist party if he had chosen to, if there was one. And as it was, there were candidates in legitimate parties who commanded substantial portions, not overwhelming, but substantial portions of their party's votes for not getting involved in this war. You know, it's the same old American feeling. You know, we live on our own continent here. This was in the days before this kind of super international technology that existed, like intercontinental ballistic missiles, et cetera. Bombers that could fly all the way across the ocean in one leap and still have plenty of room to do what they needed to do. This didn't exist. So, all right, we're here. Let them all kill each other over there in Europe. You know, who cares? That's what they do. They've been doing it for, 2,000 years. Let them keep killing each other over there. It's not our problem. But, in fact, it was our problem for various reasons. Some of the best ones, though, for democracy and for equality. So the whole idea of the occupied, but now we're in a war. In Iraq, in Afghanistan, we theoretically have ended the war in Iraq, but of course we haven't. There are still tens of thousands of American mercenaries, State Department employees, and God knows how many CIA people with the drones there. But in Afghanistan, we still have tens and tens and tens of thousands of troops, and we're supposed to be drawing them down this year. But there's already, of course, which is not a shock, discussion there about how many troops we're going to be keeping to bolster the Afghan army, which is as close to the Keystone Cops with real guns as you could possibly imagine. Everybody who has any brains at all, if they don't want to be completely brainwashed by this crap from the Defense Department and things that politicians say, or generals, knows very well, clearly anybody could see this, that the minute we pull out of there, if we actually did pull our troops out, within 2 months, the Taliban would be running that country again. Maybe 4 weeks. I don't know. That's how fast the Afghanistan army would be, such as they are, would be defeated. In fact, the Afghanistan army would suddenly become part of the Taliban, probably very quickly. But the point is, we are in that place now for 11 years. We have been occupying another country. We invaded, and now we have occupied another country for 11 years. It has become a permanent career path, an industry for weapons manufacturers and people in the military. It's not America anymore, not America we ever knew. Because in World War II, we went over there, did what we had to do, and people were very glad to come home. It was not a military nation. It was always something of an empire, but we didn't quite realize that yet and put it in practice on a national level, or at least we weren't all aware of it. So the idea was that this was a citizen democracy. We gathered an army together because we had to. We went over, and a lot of people lost their lives. 300,000 Americans died in that war, and several hundred thousand more injured, disabled in their minds and bodies for the rest of their lives. The whole economy turned upside down. But we came back. When we were done, we did not occupy that place, except there were some remnants left over in Germany because of Russia, you know, and then also in Japan and bases like Okinawa. And then we had some remnants in South Korea. But essentially, we went over there and came back because this is a country, at least at that time, that wasn't committed in its soul to invading and occupying other countries. If we were already an empire, we didn't understand it and we didn't take it seriously. It hadn't been institutionalized as part of America. Now America is institutionalized as a worldwide empire. We are on the wane, and that's a good thing for the world, by the way. But we are still we're like the Roman Empire in the world now. Yeah, I know we don't do those kinds of awful things, but we are still the Roman Empire of the world, as close as it gets. I mean, we're the big colossus that strides the world right now. And whoever would have thought? I mean, you know, in my lifetime, when I was growing up, we didn't think about America that way. Now we weren't very well educated. And that's another whole story. The American education has always been extremely lacking, and there was a lot of brainwashing going on, things left out of history books. But the idea was, if you were a kid, put it this way in a simple way we could all understand, and that I could understand. You're having a daydream. It's 1955, and I'm a 10-year-old. I'm playing with soldiers in my backyard, and you're having a daydream, right? The daydream is that you're a soldier. In World War II, and you're a big hero. This is what a lot of the boys felt like. Because we looked around and saw these guys. They were heroes to us, right? They had the uniforms on Memorial Day. They had their medals. They talked about the war. We thought them as real heroes, every last one of them, especially the guys who had been in combat. And so you play soldiers, right? And then you win the battle. You set up a little battle. We had a little toys. We had lead soldiers from Woolworths, and we set up a battle, and we won. And then we went in and we had a sandwich and we watched TV or we did our homework or something like that. In other words, we came home. We didn't play occupy another country for 12 years, set up bases, corrupt governments on an ongoing basis. This was not part of our games. It's not how Americans thought. Anyhow, back to the Occupy movement. So Mitt Romney is running against, Barack Obama. I don't know. You can't reduce these things to mathematical formulas. However, the idea of income inequality became one of the, if not the major discussion because of Occupy, because of the Occupy movement, became the major discussion of the election. And now, it wasn't that this didn't exist before, obviously. It did, this insane, obscene income gap between almost all of us and a few rich people who run the government and own it. But the Occupy movement pointed it out. As short-lived as they were and as many defects as they have, a lot of the Occupy people were students who didn't want to go to school. They were middle-class drifters. They were professional agitators. Yeah, it's all true. All this kind of stuff that some of the right wing was saying about them is true. It's partially true. But a lot of them were people who were down and out, people who had political beliefs, and people who didn't want this to go on anymore. And that's true, too. And the core idea was income inequality and is income inequality. It stays that way. And because various mayors like Rahm Emanuel and Bloomberg and a few other places and the mayor of Oakland and a couple of other places on campus like at UC Davis, because they beat people up and sprayed them with pepper spray and arrested everybody and tore everything apart at the campsites, they figure it's gone. They like to think that. People who are billionaires figure if they keep you shut up and lock you up enough that you don't have that idea anymore. It doesn't exist anymore. But, of course, that's not true. So the Occupy movement grew up. This show grew out of the Occupy movement. To support it the way that we felt, a lot of people in our generation, from the 60s generation, felt finally encouraged. Because after the 70s and the 80s, we had gone 40 years, a lot of us, 30, 40 years, not seeing the slightest trickle or the slightest ripple of protest in America. Even though things were getting worse and worse and worse for a lot of people, there was, in fact, no draft, of course. And then, civil rights was not as big an issue because although a lot of black people are still suffering mightily and as a population have much less than white people, there weren't the actual beatings, the dogs being sicked on people, people Can now sit at lunch counters. They can run for mayor. They can vote generally, except, of course, for the latest voter suppression. But the issue became very big in this election. If it wasn't for the Occupy movement and the issue of income inequality, it could easily be that Romney would have beat Obama. But the fact that they picked exactly the wrong guy and didn't have the pulse of what America felt from this Occupy movement idea, income inequality, where they got a guy who makes this now famous secret speech where he talks about 47% of people never going to vote for me. They're a bunch of helpless victims who want to live off the rest of us. All this stuff about they built it and all this crap. Basically, they were running on a 1% platform and they lost. So the idea of the 99 and the 1, the idea of income inequality, was in fact, I think, the biggest idea, despite whatever other issues were raised that were important, you know, social issues or defense or whatever, war. Citizens United. The biggest idea was income inequality. And why? Because it informs in a complete and awful way everything else in our culture. The idea of income inequality informs ownership of land, who gets selected to be politicians, who gets selected to be judge. In fact, income inequality forms our government. It even changes the laws our government uses to get by. I mean, privatizing is everywhere. So, saying all of this aloud, really just to say that although the show is not about the Occupy movement per se, because there really isn't an Occupy movement on the ground anymore, it is about the idea of income inequality. And as I go on from this point, after like, you know, to be almost like roughly a year's anniversary of the Occupy movement, what I want to do and get suggestions from people, and then I'll tell you in a minute a way to do this, is interview people. We'll be talking about issues here and then interviewing people from time to time who make positive contributions. I mean, it's easy enough, as many people tell me often, and I understand this, to criticize things. And that's necessary to do that because most major news organizations or even online and other places will not point out that the emperor has new clothes. So that's what's valuable sometimes about shows like this. But to try to put on people who are developing alternative ways. And now I'm trying to line up interviews on this show with people who are studying alternative ways to change the rules of the way our Congress works, to amend the Constitution so that there is more equality, to change the way people actually vote so it's more equal and so it's not just this one black or white vote between two parties. Things like that, the way people grow food in an alternative way, the way people can supply or even run businesses in an alternative way. Does it all have to be capitalism until the day we die, you know, on this treadmill of capitalism? I don't know. But now that so that's what we're going to do on this show. And the way to check in on this show when we're not on, we're only on once a week here on Thursdays at 2 p.m., but go to the website, which is a continual dialogue. It's not the website, I keep saying it. It's a Facebook page. We have a Facebook page which started out with, you know, as usual, practically nobody on it, and now has several hundred people checking in on it every day. Even actually, I think it's close to 1,000 people taking a look at it, and some people liking it, and other people who have become friends of this Facebook page. It's called Occupied Territory, and it's about all the issues I was just talking about. And it is, and because the election is over, doesn't mean that we're not still living in occupied territory and the rich still don't run us and they're still running us into the ground, right? So all of these issues about changing the rules of our democracy, the way the laws work, going after the real bad guys, which now the Justice Department is doing more aggressively, sort of, after the election. They didn't want to offend too many rich people during the election. But the minute the election is over, they're going after one of the biggest hedge fund managers in the entire world, a guy named Steve Cohn, who lives in New York. Stephen Cohn, who actually lives in Greenwich, Connecticut, but he's from New York. So they're really, now the Justice Department is doing their job when they don't look like they're too aggressive after the election has occurred. So check in on the Facebook page as often as you can or post things there. So it's Occupied Territory on Facebook. Just Google Facebook and Occupied Territory. It'll take you right there. I post things on it sometimes every day, sometimes every other day. Articles, things I think are of interest, things people should know about. Sometimes we have running political debates, which we did during the election because I was very much for Jill Stein and not for the other corporate candidate, Mr. Obama. And people post videos on there. It's a good, active, interesting, intelligent-looking website, Facebook page. So go there and check in. And if you have any suggestions from this point on about things you want to hear on this program or people you want interviewed, I'll try to follow them up. And I'm going to be lining up my own people, too. The latest thing that I've been posting on there on Occupied Territory, and you can check it out, and that I've been talking about on the air here, is what's going on with Walmart. Now, Walmart is the largest employer in the country. In fact, it's the largest employer in the world. I don't know how many branches they have, thousands and thousands of branches, department stores, and centers, Sam's Club, or whatever it is, a million things. But in this country, Walmart employs 1.4 million people. They are the largest employer in this country. And, of course, the average wage is basically keeping people close to or below a poverty line. They don't generally employ people full-time because that, you know, that means they can shift them around as much as they want. There is no union at Walmart. 1.4 million people who are basically insulted, disrespected, treated in any way that the management feels like they're called up the day before and told what hours they can have or they're going to have any hours at all. They start off at, I think, at $8 an hour. And if they work really hard and they're good and they smile a lot and they don't fall down and break anything, they can make in 2 years maybe $10 an hour. You can't live on that, especially if you're only working 20 or 30 hours a week. And they shift people around. They don't want a lot of people working full time at Walmart. Now, you would think it would be good business practices to do this, right? To have people working full-time who you can rely on. But no, they don't have that because they can keep people off balance and they can, in the end, prevent unionization easier if they suddenly call you up and tell you you're not coming in tomorrow or for the next 2 days or suddenly tell you what shift you're working. If you have no rights whatsoever there. Also, the managers are routinely abusive all over the country. Some of the working conditions are downright unhealthy. They have faulty equipment. People have been hurt there. You have no rights if you work at Walmart. You have no union. And the union in this country has gone completely into the shade. Unions have been almost completely eclipsed in this country as a major force. And this is a long war that's been going on. Originally, when you go all the way back to around 1900, when unions, well, even 1880s, and then 1900, and then 1910, all in that time, when unions began to arise, when there was the other example of the Gilded Age of tremendous income inequality, where people worked in those days 7 days a week, where there were no child labor laws. You had 12-year-olds working 6 days a week in factories, and you know, dying of tuberculosis. You had no unions whatsoever. You had people working in mines 6 days a week and buying everything from the company store, so they were in debt their whole lives, who died of tuberculosis. There was no safety rules at any place where anybody worked. Machinery dropped, something dropped on you, you died, too bad. Get out. You know, take that body out, bring somebody new in. It was like being in the arena like a gladiator. Oh, that one's dead, drag them out. Let's get somebody new at this sewing machine. Let's get somebody new shoveling coal. So no unions whatsoever, no health protections, no idea of pensions or benefits at all from the tremendous, obscene, outrageous profits being made off the backbreaking, low-paid labor of tens of millions of people. And finally, people said, enough. There were disasters after disasters. There were massive attacks by hired thugs and goons and even by the American military and state police shooting down people who were striking or even attempting to strike in mines out west, in railroad yards in Chicago, in garment factories in New York City, in the coal mines of West Virginia and Kentucky. And, you know, people were being murdered. People were being starved to death. You couldn't even possibly exist. And yet you had to. There was no other way for you to live. The companies, by force or by corruption, and just the same as they do now, bought up everything. They owned everything. You worked there, did what they said, or you died. And that's how it worked. So that's why unions grew up. Slowly but surely, painfully, fatally, they grew up in this country. And unions became very, very powerful. Like anything else, unions, in some cases, became too powerful. They got a kind of and this is within the definition of capitalism as a cultural and political and economic force or, you know, as a way of running a country. Some of them got too powerful. You have people making in unions, you know, have teachers where they couldn't be fired. You have alcoholic, drunk, incompetent, sexually abusive teachers, even in the New York City school system, couldn't even be fired. Right? even bigoted teachers, they cannot be fired. The unions were so powerful in some cases, the United Auto Workers, and I'm not making a brief for anybody, transferring their jobs offshore or whatever, or, breaking a union. But unions got to be not only too powerful sometimes so that they dictated policy and they protected incompetent people in their own ranks, but a lot of unions also were corrupt and thoroughly corrupt. They were formed in violence, and a lot of them just stayed violent, like the Teamsters, famously, run by organized crime, and by the International Longshoremen's Workers Union, famously also run by the mafia. And other unions, too. Just recently in New York City, and I mean within the last few years, it took the government like 10 years to finally investigate and get rid of there are building workers in New York who work in all these big apartment buildings and office buildings. The people who were doormen, people who were maintenance workers, people who fix things in buildings, maintain elevators, whatever it is, these people were making like $30,000 a year, barely getting by, very few benefits or pensions or holidays. And the head of the union was making $400,000, giving away $200,000 assistant union no-show jobs to his family. So it took the Justice Department to get rid of this guy, right? This is what happened. So unions have a bad rep from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then things started in the 80s. It was an anti-union movement. Basically, the real bad guys, the heads of these corporations, the really rich, the people who do run the government and own everything, they said, now the unions have gone too far. Here's an opportunity, since these unions are some of them are corrupt, and since they're overbearing, and they really do protect a lot of incompetent workers, and they make it difficult for, within a capitalist context, industries to make a profit, let's get rid of them all. And it all starts with Reagan, with the government union breaking up the air controllers, organization. And it all went downhill from there. Now unions are routinely challenged and, denigrated and called out by all sorts of people on the right and by workers. However, I believe now, and this is partially because of the Occupy movement, that unions are on the way up again. These things go in historical cycles. So since the 20s, since unions, people worked hard to form unions, since the 20s and 30s, especially when Roosevelt got in, since the rise of unions till they got extremely, very, very powerful, and that was good in almost every case in the 50s, and they're all making really decent wages, and they could buy houses, whatever version of the American dream, buy cars, send their kids to school, live a decent life, retire when they didn't have to retire when they were 70 or work till they dropped or work 6 days a week. There were child labor laws where you couldn't make children work and you had to send children to school. You went down from a 70-hour week to a 64-hour week to a 54-hour week to now the 40-hour week, so that your whole life isn't spent in complete and utter arduous toil, that you have other things you can do with your life. Of course, one of the reasons why people, why major corporations liked that was because they made so many entertainment devices and so many things like Disneyland and TV and everything. They needed people to have leisure time. You know, when people had no leisure time, there was no leisure time industry, right? Now, leisure time industry, television and all these other places and theme parks and whatever, a thousand other things that add up to hundreds of billions of dollars of money that people spend on leisure time. Nobody needed to have an industry like that because nobody had any leisure time once upon a time. So these things are they all come with their own, complex downside and obverse side of the coin. Meanwhile, now unions have been pretty much sneered at, looked down on. And now that banks have destroyed, basically the gangsterism of banks and the corruption of government has destroyed the economy, unions are seen many times by Tea Party types and Republicans as the villains again. In the last several years, they've been cast as the villains because they want their pensions are too high. The pension requirements to meet the retirement pension requirements of public employees is so high that in a lot of places, states and municipalities have declared bankruptcy or have stopped paying these pensions. So you get the specter of places, small towns and even one or two small cities in this country, where people work 20, 30, 35 years as policemen or cops, policemen or firemen or sanitation workers, who spent their lives in toil protecting people, keeping people safe, keeping people clean, saving people's lives. They retire. They get to be 65, 70 years old. All of a sudden, they don't have a pension. The city just stopped paying their pension. So these people are now in food stamps and all living together under one roof, things falling apart, can't afford to live. This is how it goes. But I believe now, after all this income inequality stuff, based on what Occupy was doing, and what you saw in the last election, and the sense in the country that we can't go on like this, having only a few rich people own and run and control everything, and the rest of us just struggling along. And I, you know, I'm not poverty stricken. Between my wife and I, we make, I don't know, what, $75,000, $80,000 a year. Not a lot of money these days. But we just, you know, pay our bills. We've got debts we pay off. We live in a sort of very small apartment, and we don't take that many vacations or do that much. And somehow the money gets eaten up, you know, after taxes and after this and after that, after health problems, whatever, after things that we do for other people, give some money to charity. There isn't much money left. And everybody understands that. So when they talk about the federal poverty level being, and it's a joke, what is the federal poverty level? I think for one person it's $20,000. Maybe for a family of three it's $30,000. Try living on that. Try being by yourself living on $20,000 a year. What a sad, stupid, obscene joke that is. And that's what the rich, but the rich people set the poverty level. That's why I love this. The rich people, like in the last election, which you had, is a lot of rich people, especially two rich guys, arguing about what kind. Right now, you've got an entire group of people. You've got a whole Congress, and you've got other people arguing with each other and coming to a bargain. This is only several hundred people we're talking about, and all the lobbyists and everybody involved. You've got several hundred people, including the president and the leaders of Congress. All these people are either millionaires or work for millionaires. They're arguing about how much we're going to get cut from our Social Security, our health benefits, libraries, senior centers, things that are essential to our everyday lives, sometimes that are essential to our actually living at all. They're going to cut all these things. And so millionaires are arguing about what's going to happen to the rest of us. What's new, right? So back to Walmart. Walmart, it's a perfect symbol. And I've been featuring Walmart and will continue to feature Walmart because they were, in the last couple of months, especially on Black Friday, there were several walkouts at dozens and dozens of Walmart stores across the country. These were very small walkouts. The public relations people tried to make a big deal out of it, and I get all their stuff, like the union PR people and all. And I had some of these workers on my show at Sirius. I had a couple on here on Occupied Territory. And I'm going to continue to feature this story. And although only maybe a total of 5,000 people over, 1.4 million people walked out or demonstrated. By the way, I should mention that only one politician in this entire country, one congressman out of the entire bunch of elected national officials, managed to take it upon himself down in Florida to go into a Walmart store, walk a striker out the door, and stand with her in a picket line. That's Alan Grayson in Florida. Who I have talked to a couple of times on Sirius. He is, although he's a very strange and exuberant character in many ways that embarrasses the Democratic Party, when a man does a thing like that, you know he's the real deal, right? The man, it wasn't just showboating, right? He walked into a Walmart store and walked this woman out along with a few of her coworkers because of the disrespect, the lack of conditions, and the ridiculously obscene pay. So once again, you have Walmart, and it is a living example of everything that's wrong with America. You've got the Walton family that has $120 billion. They don't even work for a living, you understand. These are people who don't even work for a living and may not most of their lives have ever even so much as worked. They just have this money because they inherited it, or they make this money. They don't really make it. I mean, it comes to them because they own these stores, right? You got five people with $120 billion. They pay people $8 an hour. These people live in trailers if they can manage to even live inside any place. They don't give them enough full-time hours. They don't give them really decent health benefits. They treat them like crap. They disrespect them. This is the next place, Walmart. This is the next place. And Walmart isn't just 1.4 million workers who are treated badly. Walmart is like a giant octopus that has its tentacles in everything in America. They control the destinies of small food suppliers, of food growers, of factory workers in other countries. Millions, hundreds of millions of people are dependent in one way or another on Walmart, not just the 1.4 million people who work at their stores or warehouses. For instance, just a few days ago, you may have read about this, in Bangladesh, where the country is, direly poor, where people practically have like make about $5 or $3 a day to live on. Their largest industry is garment industry, where people, just like in the garment industry in New York City in the 1910s and the 1920s, live in these. They work in these really cramped loft factories where they have to work, many, many hours a day, several days a week, to just get enough food to eat and live in crummy, shacks and crummy, broken down apartment buildings. Walmart gets whatever they sell in Walmart comes from places, and Walmart can dictate the price lower and lower and lower. They pay truckers less money than anybody else because they are Walmart. So if you don't like it, then go get a job somewhere else. There aren't any jobs anywhere else. If you grow food somewhere, your prices are lower and you have to live a less good life because Walmart buys up so much of your food and they dictate the price. So you see how it works. Walmart sells, I think one of their brands is called Faded Glory, which is such crap. But Faded Glory, Walmart sells hundreds of millions of garments, of articles of clothing a year, and they have their own brands and they sell other brands. These things are made by almost slave labor in several other countries. One of the major ones is Bangladesh, where the majority of the population of Bangladesh work in these nasty lofts and garment factories, just almost as bad as the ones that were in New York City around the turn of the last century. And they had a giant fire there the other day. In Bangladesh, over 100 people were burned to death, most of them women, burned to death. And it was only 100 people. It could have been 500 people burned to death in this big factory building with 10 different floors, I think, because people had knocked off for work. A lot of the people in the building had knocked off for work. There were still only a couple of hundred people left. It would have been several hundred people. So over 100 people burned to death to the point where they were unrecognizable by their relatives, just charred embers, right, and skeletons. And a lot of other people were disfigured and are in tremendous pain. There are fires and accidents like this all over Bangladesh all the time. These people supply stuff directly to Walmart. Walmart doesn't accept responsibility because they subcontract things, and this is their sneaky, sleazy legal way of getting out of it. It's not Walmart that owns this factory. It's Wazin Industries, or, 2-4 corporation subcontracts to Wazin, blah, blah, blah. Walmart's in charge of this. And the safety, the dangers of the lack of safety equipment, the dangers of locked exits, they had the same thing. It never stops. Locked doors where people couldn't get out and jammed together. People had to jump off the roof, just like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, which was a turning point for not only American labor and American inequality of pay and of rights. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, where over 100 women and young girls died because of the way they were treated by these people, and children died in this fire, two teenage girls. It was a turning point in American history. The same thing happened in Bangladesh the other day, and it's the same kind of thing, and it's the same kind of people. And Walmart is responsible for this, although they completely deny it. So the trick is, watch Walmart from now on. They are trying to form a union. Some people walked out the other day, but not that many. I mean, who could afford to do it? Put it this way with Walmarts. Each one of the Walmart siblings has something like $25 billion. If you wanted to pay every person, 1.4 million people, you want to pay every person who works at Walmart in this country a decent wage, let's call it $40,000 a year. On a full-time job with decent benefits, it would cost about $22 billion, roughly, $22 billion. It would still leave one sibling with $3 billion and the rest with all their $25 billion. But nobody will do that until they're forced to do it. How do we force them to do it? That's partially what this show has to be about. People who have all this money, people who bribe and own politicians, people who make the laws, people who treat people like dirt when all they want to do is work and have a life and amass tens of billions of dollars, that's not right. That has to be changed. The question is, how do we change it? And that's what this show will be all about. Meanwhile, it's not just here. A place like Walmart keeps people dying and poverty-stricken all over the world. If this doesn't change, then it ultimately becomes just pure corporate fascism, which is what we see all the time in this country. So we're going to keep an eye on Walmart. We're going to have people on here who talk about that. And this fire over there may change things in Bangladesh. I don't know. It may change things over here. But we'll see what happens. Change is what it's all about. Alternative change, not usually the usual political shenanigans and channels.